how important is it to be grounded in the subject of creation? That is Genesis chapter 1:1 through chapter 2, verse 3. What it says in the Scriptures, and I'm not primarily going to be preaching from Genesis 1. That is going to be our main text. We're going to go there, but we're going to do much more than that tonight. But I thought that it would be wise for all of us to hear, I'm sure for some, and maybe the first time, what is out there? What is being taught in the world? In fact, more than that, or more specifically, what is being taught in Christian, not to say the secular now, but in Christian colleges and universities? Not all of them, not the one that I used to teach at. We believed in literal creation. Every faculty member, staff member had to, and so we believed that, you know, in six literal 24-hour consecutive days, God created the universe. And that not very long ago, thousands of years, not hundreds of thousands or millions, or certainly not billions of years ago. There may be some sitting here who right now are waffling on that subject. And you may be thinking, this is going to be interesting because, you know, I read this book and, or I watched this show, or, you know, just the accumulated, so many scientists argue that, okay, and boom, you know, can tick those things off. Well, what we want to do tonight is take a survey of five different positions, okay, when it comes to creation. Four of them believe in God and that God created this universe. One of them does not believe in God and rejects Him and rejects the idea of the supernatural. So we're going to look at five different views tonight. And I'd like to start this evening by referring to the National Geographic Society website and an article there that whose author, David Quammen, was rather concerned about America because of something that he found. After giving arguments for evolution, a National Geographic Society contributor, David Quammen, expressed concern about the percentage of Americans who reject it. What percentage of Americans would you guess reject naturalistic evolution? Say that Darwin had it wrong. Would you put that at 10%? Maybe 20%? What would you guess? Please allow me to read some excerpts, small ones, from this article on the National Geographic website. Quammen writes, according to a Gallup poll, we all know Gallup. Gallup is a group of high repute. Their polls are well done, scientifically monitored, and so forth. So according to a Gallup poll drawn from more than 1,000 telephone interviews conducted in February of 2001, no less than, what percentage did you think it would be? What percentage of Americans do you think reject evolution and accept a literal creation? That is, that the earth was created, the universe was created in the last few thousand years. He says, this interview, 1,000 telephone interviews conducted in 2001, found that no less than, it shocked me when I read it, 45% of responding U.S. adults agreed that, and here's what the Gallup poll question was, God created human beings pretty much in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years or so. If you'd have asked me, I'd have said 10%, maybe 20. 45% of the respondents that answered this question believe in a young earth. Now, well, you know, there is statistically the possibility of a 2 to 3 to 4% error, you know, either way. I mean, that still leaves us, you know, upwards of 40%. Well, maybe it was just a fluke. No, it's not, as you'll see in just a minute. He says, continuing, evolution by their lights played no role in shaping us. Only 37% of the polled Americans were satisfied with allowing room for both God and Darwin. Three of the views that we'll look at either tonight or next week, depending on time, will be a preview of many views that are out there regarding that. That is, Christians that believe that the earth is really, really old and that God created everything billions of years ago in a very simplistic form and that he used evolution to bring us to our present state. All right, continuing with his quote. He says, that is, they're arguing that divine initiative is what got things started, evolution as the creative means. Still fewer Americans, only 12%, believed that humans evolved from other life forms without any involvement of a God. Only 12% of Americans believed in naturalistic evolution, that is, straight on Darwin. That surprised me too. What's the ultimate result then? 6% didn't respond or responded unsure. So that means that 82% of Americans in the year 2001 believed that God created them in some way. Only 12% rejected God. Now what's most startling, to me anyway, is not just the stat from 2001. It's the fact that Gallup has done that poll not just once in 2001, but has done it 5 times. Same questions. The first time they did it was 1982. Then they did it in 93, 97, and 1999. And guess what? The creationist conviction that God alone and not evolution produced humans has never drawn less than 44%. Now that, can I use, you know, the vernacular, blew me away. We're looking at basically almost half of the populace of the United States. It wasn't a fluke in 2001. It's been solid, steady since 1982 and probably was even greater before then. That huge percentage of Americans believe in God and that he created in the last 10,000 years or so recently. Now, that still leaves a goodly portion of those who call themselves Christians somewhere in the middle, right? So what's our, can we call it a spectrum of belief? What's our spectrum here? Well, on either side, the purists out there, and I'm one of them, on either side is naturalistic evolution, which we'll define momentarily, and literal creationism, which is where we at our church are. Okay, so those are the two extremes or the two edges. What's in the middle? We're only going to look at three views that are in the middle. There are a multiplicity of them. And I just don't think it's necessary and probably not helpful for me to bring 20 different views that are in the middle. We'll look at three very well-known views and we'll that should suffice. One of the great questions that Christians, in fact, every worldview is important, and we won't get off on that, but one of the great questions that Christians and every worldview must answer is this: where does man come from? People have been asking that for as long as they've been around. Where does man come from? How do people answer this question? We're going to consider five different answers to that. As already mentioned, we'll look at naturalistic evolution and literal creationism, and then we'll look at three views that are in the middle. Maybe tonight, maybe it'll be next week. We will also consider deistic evolution. What is that? That's the view that most of our founding fathers of America believed. That was the prevailing view of, let's say, you know, a Thomas Jefferson. Okay? So we'll look at deistic evolution. It won't take us long. Theistic evolution and what that means and how that's different from deistic. And then we'll consider what is by far the most prevalent view among Christians who aren't young earthers, and that is progressive creationism. Really important for us to hear that and know what that is. It is important for us as grandparents, as parents, as teenagers, in fact, even my own children and the children here. My prayer is that you will listen as well. Because you watch TV, you see videos, you are either already reading or will soon be reading these things, you'll be bombarded by this. It behooves us as an assembly to know what these positions are. Now, those three middle views, deistic evolution, theistic evolution, and progressive creationism, they are trying to harmonize what they see as two tensions. Tensions that are pulling them one way and then the other. What do you think that those two tensions are? I'll give you just a moment to ponder that. I'm not looking for a raise of hand or response here, but what do you think a progressive creationist, what is he wrestling with or she wrestling with? What are their perceived tensions? Well, they are these. On the one hand, there is the, notice I'm putting this in, you know, quotes with my fingers here because I don't believe this, but there is the quote fact that the universe is really old, as in 14 to 20 billion years old, supposedly proven by the various fields of science, which we will most likely go ahead and take three more weeks after the first two and treat. In other words, I don't want us to be caught off guard or on our heels when someone says, yeah, you Christians, I mean, radioisotope dating or, you know, carbon-14 dating proves that you're wrong. Well, does it? What I'd like to do is present either 14 or maybe 15. I'm still working on the last one and deciding whether or not I'm going to put it in. But look at 14 or 15 evidence. There are over 50, but I'd like to look at either 14 or 15 evidences from science that support a young earth, young universe, creationist position. Perhaps we'll do those 14 or 15 in the 3 weeks after we get back from vacation. Tonight, we're looking at these five views. Three of them are trying to, quote, deal with two tensions. On the one hand, it's the idea that the universe is really old, that science supposedly can prove. And then on the other hand, it's that the Bible teaches that God created everything. So how do you If these are both true, how do you get them to mesh? Deistic evolution, theistic evolution, progressive creationism are three answers, three different answers for how those might mesh. I don't agree with any of those, but we want to talk about them. All right. In my opinion, the three middle views compromise truth for no reason. Science does not prove that the earth is old. Naturalistic evolutionists believe it's old. They have faith. Yes, it is faith. Thoroughgoing faith. You talk a leap of faith. Evolution is one huge leap of faith. And hopefully tonight we'll begin to explain why. So let's talk tonight, to begin with, about these two outer positions, the left and the right, naturalistic evolution and literal creationism. We'll start with naturalistic evolution. It might surprise you to know, I did share my salvation testimony about a year ago, well, maybe not that long, but you know, 9 months ago with the church. You might have forgotten. I was not born and raised in a Christian home. I went to public school and totally bought into I still believed in God, but I believed that the universe was really, really old and that human beings had evolved from probably the higher primates. Not the monkeys, but the apes. You know, monkeys have tails, apes. All right, anyway. You know, so that's what I truly believed. And my biology teacher, Mr. Spain, was one of the best teachers that I ever had in high school. And he did a great job indoctrinating us with evolution. And he sincerely believed it and taught it. And I completely bought it. And then I got saved. And then I had to wrestle with that. So, you know, I'm a believer then, and I still am holding on, at least for the first year, holding on to naturalistic evolution, and my pastor bought me a couple of books, and I read them, and they helped me tremendously. Now, what does that naturalistic evolution teach? Look, nobody believes that Darwin is exactly right. Nobody. Today, those who would reject the idea of God and say that, you know, the universe is just time and chance, and we're here basically because of luck, accident, if you will, they would argue that there is no supernatural. That's naturalistic evolution. Darwin, it's a modified form of Darwinianism. There is no such thing as God. There's no such thing as miracles. There's no such thing as a being who's out there and above us who can or did create us. They believe that with chance and enough time, the universe as we see it evolved from a simple state. So, how do they promote this idea? Well, first it all starts with, and we've probably all heard this, the Big Bang. Supposedly, all of the matter in the entire universe, or at least most of it, was compacted down into a really small sphere. A sphere that we could hold in our hand, except that it would be so intensely heavy that we'd never be able to lift it or even hold it up. Because we realize, right, that this first wooden pew here is thoroughly hollow. You know, you say, what? Well, from the molecular standpoint, on the molecular level, there's almost nothing here. Even though it looks and feels like it's all here, this thing is mostly empty space. It's true. Atoms, nuclei, all right. So it's mostly empty space. It just looks like it's all there. But in reality, you know, the things that we see are, you know, are largely empty space. So, including our bodies and so forth. So could it be that all of the matter of the universe, if all that space were removed, could actually fit? Well, even today, the expert mathematical physicists have tried and tried and tried to mathematically make the Big Bang work. And I mean, I have videos that are really recent, and they say we just can't make it work. It makes no sense. We cannot get there. We've tried and tried from all kinds of mathematical angles, and we cannot see how the Big Bang could have actually, you know, they doubt it, or at least seriously question it. So already we're seeing some of like the core beliefs in naturalistic evolution, not just a, no, all they're all under major attack today, even internally from their own fields, the Big Bang being one of them. But supposedly, the Big Bang started it all. Matter was condensed, it exploded, and it went out, and some of that matter ended up kind of coagulating in our neighborhood of the universe. It was just floating around. And somehow, how? We don't know. But we'll take it by faith that it happened. Somehow, all that matter got together and created our sun. It's pretty good. Explosions usually tear things apart. They don't build them. But anyway, I don't know how it happened, but by faith, that sun somehow got together, and so did eight planets in our solar system. And those eight planets just happened to be spinning and happened to get into an elliptical orbit, and, you know, and the space-time fabric of the universe just happened to come into being. Wow. What a... That's amazing. Yeah, you really have to have a lot of faith to believe that that could have happened. But let's just say that it did. And that somehow the Earth and the Moon were able to get positioned such that the Moon could control the water. Oh, wait, hold on. How did we get that water? Oh, well, anyway, I'm not exactly sure how we got the water, but somehow we got that water. And a lot of it. And somehow the Moon was able to control the tides, and there ended up being dry land. And you know what else there ended up being, according to naturalistic evolution? There ended up being what is called, and this is way back, you know, my science professor and you know, up till the modern day, there ended up being a primordial pool of soup, it's so called. In other words, this really thick, loaded pond of kind of like scum, lots of stuff in it, including what? A whole host of amino acids. You understand that that your body is designed, programmed by not a, you know, when we talk about, we've got a number of techie people in here, computer programmers, right? They think binomial, ones and zeros. Well, our computer program, if you will, that controls how big our ears are, what color our eyes are, you know, on and on and on. That program is not binomial, it's quadnomial. It's four, not two. There are four different amino acids, right, Crick and so forth. You know, they figured out the double helix, that little DNA strand, 3 billion nucleotide pairs in a human being that control. All right, now, back to the primordial pool of soup. There were these amino acids. So, now, where did they come from? I don't know. But I'll have to believe by faith, I guess, that they somehow got there. Not even sure how the land got there and the water got there or how the amino acids got there, but somehow they ended up in that pool of soup. So we get these amino acids in the pool of soup. It's amazing, especially given that it all started with an explosion. But they're there. And you want to know what's even more amazing than that? I mean, it's incredible. These amino acids. Maybe it was a lightning strike. Where did lightning come from? I don't know where lightning came from, but somehow we end up with lightning. And you know what? Somehow lightning struck that pool of soup. It energized, caused energy to surge through that pond and caused those amino acids to pair up into a fairly complex strand of DNA. Wow. It's amazing. I mean, I'm telling you, that is so amazing. You know what? That takes a lot of faith to believe that that could happen. But let's just suppose that it did happen. So we have these, probably tens of thousands would be needed. I know we have 3 billion in a human being, but maybe in really like the most basic form, could even, you know, tens of thousands do it? I doubt it. But let's just say tens of thousands of these amino acids came together and created the first program. The first one that when they came together, somehow instantaneously generated life. No life. Lightning, life. The amino acids come together, create an incredibly intensely complex strand. But, you know, even if you have the strand, do you have life? I mean, does the strand by itself, I mean, take a piece of DNA and lay it in a petri dish. I mean, does it generate life by itself? I mean, there has to be a process to create the shell and, you know, of the organism and all the things in the, but all right, now, I don't know how it happened. Let's just take it. It's a big step of faith, but let's take it by faith that those amino acids got together and somehow create a single cell life form, an amoeba, if you will. You see them when you're in, you know, high school and they're swimming in the water under the microscope. Okay, so they create an amoeba. Now, this is really amazing because, you know what? This amoeba has got to be able to eat, that is, take in nutrients. How did that happen? I don't know, but it did. This amoeba has to be able to excrete the waste. Wow, that computer code, or that, you know, DNA code must have been really, it must have been really complex. So this thing was able to take in and excrete. It was able to digest. It was able to, at the very least, survive the temperature and the, you know, the, oh my God. You know, the x-rays, that's amazing. All right, think about this now. This thing also has to have circulation of a sort. It's got to absorb the nutrients. It's got to reproduce. Wow, that is so amazing that all of that ended up happening by a lightning strike. Probably that lightning had to hit that pool 100,000 times, maybe 1,000,000 times before the DNA got in the right strand and life was created. Yeah, but if you've got one amino acid, how does it recreate itself? Think about it. What takes more faith? To believe that there is a being greater than us who is up there and out there who created and who has communicated to us about that very act, or that a big bang, an explosion created the sun, you know, all of the physical laws that created planets and put water on it and just happened to put the moon at the right distance. And wow, creates a molten core in the earth. How did that molten core get to, we could go off and, what are we saying? When your science professor in college, I've sat on the plane next to him. In fact, I sat on a plane. I'd never even heard of Lakeland. I don't remember how many years ago. I think I was flying to Taiwan or somewhere, and I ended up right in front of this professor from Lakeland. Actually, right behind this professor in the line waiting to get our tickets. That was before e-tickets and all that. And I wanted to start witnessing to him, so I struck up a conversation, and he was, I can't even remember what he taught. Anyway, long story short, he's kind of, almost laughing at me like, oh man, you're a backward kook. And I'm saying, you believe all this by faith and go through some of this. He wouldn't hear it, but what takes more faith? When your biology or your chemistry or your physics professors tell you that faith is silly and it's a crutch, who's got faith, you should ask? Me or you? You're the one with faith. If we do, and we probably will, look at these evidences for a young earth and a young universe, you'll see that it's not one field of science. All the fields of science have serious, serious problems within them. So that's enough for naturalistic evolution, other than to say, of course, the amoeba ends up living, and then somehow the mutations end up adding information and it gets better, right? You start with an amoeba and then you go to a cat and then you go back to like a 4-cell organism and then it gets, because cats are right on the, all right, forget it. All right. Okay. So mutations don't add information. Mutations always subtract from the DNA. You've got a huge problem right there. You've got to take a huge leap of faith to believe that a mutation is going to add information to the DNA strand. It doesn't. Mutations always. What is science? It is by definition observation. And every observation ever made regarding a mutation shows that a mutation shrinks the DNA. It doesn't grow the DNA strand. Big problems for evolution. We're not even beginning. But somehow, by faith, even though we have never seen it in science, in observations, somehow those mutations end up adding information to the amoeba, and it eventually, after it goes to cat and then to 4-cell and so forth, it gets up to ape and then to eventually to us. Wow. Natural selection weeds out the weaker forms and we end up where we are today. I'm telling you, that it takes a lot of faith. But on the other hand, that is on the other side. The second view is literal creationism. This teaches literal creationism. This is where I am. This is where the Bible, Genesis 1, would be. Literal creationism teaches that God created the universe out of nothing. Now, not all of his creation is ex nihilo. Maybe you've heard that, okay, which means out of nothing. Not all of it is. Adam and Eve are not ex nihilo, are they? No, God scooped dust up and molded that dust. That's not ex nihilo. That is, there's immediate creation. God uses some of the things he's already created to form man. So just think about it. You're a dirt bag. Okay, sorry, I just had to say that. We're all dirt bags. All rats. Oh, I thought better of myself until now. Okay. So God creates the universe out of nothing. Ex nihilo. And then he continues to create after day one, 5 successive days. But God's not done creating. Like some people mistakenly, they haven't thought about it, mistakenly say, it's not that God just stops creating, period, on day 6. Almost all of his creative acts are done at that point. Then he rests on day 7. That's not to say that God will never create again anywhere in the Bible. at the fall, Genesis 3, God makes a whole creative swath, does he not? I mean, he creates thistles, thorns, he creates beets. I mean, think of all the things that God created on Genesis 3. Sorry for a few of you like beets. Okay, I'm not one. My wife loves mine. Okay. Now, please don't don't be mean to me when I come over to your house. All right. Okay. Big, huge thing of beets. Okay. So, God did create after the 6 days of creation, but that's not what he's normally doing. All right. So God creates the universe out of nothing. The universe and all that is within it is a creative act or successive set of creative acts of God. Almost all of it created on the 6 days. Some of it created after the fall of Adam and Eve. But again, those would be six literal 24-hour days. And they are consecutive days. That's within a seven-day week. God created and on the seventh day rested. And that a few thousand years ago, not millions or billions of years ago. Now, if you walk into my office up here, the church pastoral office, and you go in the door, you'll see above the desk there a number of books. I don't really have, I'm all messed up right now. I have more than half of my library in boxes. I've got to build some shelves. It's terrible. You have no idea what it's like. You know, can you imagine being a carpenter and having about 40% of your tools? It doesn't work, okay? I mean, I am constantly in a mess trying to find a book, can't find it. I mean, it's again and again and again. So right now I've got some systematic theologies, just a few, some select ones up there. If you were to walk into my office and look at what those, each one of those systematic theologies say regarding creation, these are conservative, truly conservative evangelical writers, and the majority of them believe in an older, not a younger. I mean, you got, men of yesteryear like Augustus Strong and B.B. Warfield who believed in an old earth. Today you have men like Millard Erickson, Wayne Grudem, Norman Geisler, and the list would go on, who believe in a young earth. Old and a good portion, not probably more than half, but a good portion of those who are considered evangelical Christians do not believe that Genesis 1 should be interpreted literally. I disagree. And tonight, with the time that remains, we should open to Genesis chapter 1 and read it and make some comments. As you're opening, please realize that there are two subsets of belief when it comes to literal creationism. Okay? Two subsets. Have you heard of Whitcomb and Morris? John Morris founded the Institute for Creation Research. Many of you are shaking your head. Yes. Okay? A lot of us have heard of Whitcomb. Of John Morris. Whitcomb taught as an Old Testament prof at Grace Theological Seminary for years, wrote a number of books. In fact, one of the two books my pastor first gave me when I was still an evolutionist for about that first year or so was written by Whitcomb, and it had a profound effect on my life, so I'm very thankful. They hold a subset that I disagree with. I appreciate where they are, but they do not believe, okay, that the genealogical lists in the book of Genesis are father to son, father to son, father to son. Genesis 5, Genesis 11. They believe that there are gaps in those genealogies. Gaps that could be, they argue, even up to 400 years and so forth. So they argue that creation took place somewhere maybe 6,000 to 8,000 BC, might have been a little bit earlier. So, that's the standard position of Institute for Creation Research and a whole host of Christian theologians and people out there. They're good people. I can understand why they are where they are, and they have some powerful arguments. And if you want to read Whitcomb and Morris's argument, what is like the quintessential book, one of the earliest, most important books ever written to support a literal interpretation of Genesis 1 and of the flood. Anybody want to guess? I mean, it was the Genesis record. Okay, the Genesis record, exactly, by Whitcomb and Morse. If you want to see the gap theory, that there are gaps in those genealogies, and the seven arguments why there are gaps, then read Whitcomb and Morse. And it's like, I don't know, it's after page 400, and I think it's an appendix. So read that, and you'll see what they say. I'm of a different opinion, okay? I believe that the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11 do not contain gaps. I think what it seems to say is what it says, that so-and-so was so many years old when he fathered Shem, and Shem was so many years old when he fathered Arphaxad, and Arphaxad was so many years old. And I believe Shem is actually Arphaxad's father, and Arphaxad, okay, so forth. Now, believe me, there is a lot of intricacy and argument and so forth in that. We aren't even going to begin. If you want to hear some more on that, I'd be happy to prepare some material and talk about that. But that's a whole other orbit. I will just say this. The other position is that strict genealogical model. This would be Ken Hammond answers in Genesis. Okay, that's where I would be with one caveat. I disagree with the year that Ken Ham and others set for creation, which is 4004 BC. There are some powerful arguments, okay? Very powerful. Both creating serious problems for their day and scripturally in favor of adding about 900 or so years to that genealogy. Now, if I were to go into that, it would take, you know, another half hour to explain it. I'll just say this. I believe that there are no gaps, but I also believe that there are some problems with, let's say, the strict genealogical model as is taught by at least some out there. There's a third option that is much better, in my opinion, than the genealogical gap model or dating creation at 4004 BC. Enough said for there. Now, for that, let's turn to Genesis chapter 1 and look at verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 1, Genesis. In the beginning, God was already around now, but this is the beginning of creation, of the physical universe that we observe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. This is the beginning of day one. What is God doing? He's making the basic foundation of all that will follow. You have heavens, plural, there's more than one, and you have earth. You also have what? Three basic building blocks. Heaven, earth, what's the third one? Do you see it? Water. Face of the deep, lots of water. And it says the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. When it's the word hovering there, in Hebrew, what does that mean? That's a hen laying on her eggs to incubate them. Okay? So she lays on her eggs, and she brings the chicks inside to life that way. That's the word that we have here. The Spirit is hovering over the waters, and He's going to be creating within them. And then what do we note? Look at the beginning of verse 3, and God said. Look at the beginning of verse 6, and God said. Verse 9, and God said. 11, and God said. 14, and God said. Verse 20, and God said. Verse 24, and God said. And in verse 26, then God said. So there is clearly a literary pattern here to the way that Moses is communicating Genesis 1. Each day, he is going to describe with at the beginning of the description of the specifics, and God said. And so in verse 3, and God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So light is created. God is going to add to the heavens, earth, and water. Then we come to day 2. And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. Two possibilities for the expanse. The waters are down on the earth, and it's the atmosphere, the waters in the atmosphere, or the waters are down on the earth, and when they're separated, they'll be way out there. Okay, so we'll see as we continue. Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. So God's going to take that deep water and separate it. Let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day. And God said, day 3 now, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place. Let dry land appear, and it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. There's no sin, there's no death. We're looking at a few thousand years ago, folks. A few thousand years ago. God created all of this. And it was good. No tears, no crying, no pain, no sin. Everything is good. Verse 11. Next day. Or actually, continuing on, rather. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed. So he's going to, he not only creates, you know, divides earth and sea, but he's going to add to the earth that he's just generated or allowed to come up out of the water. Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So he decorates, if you will, and generates the earth. There was evening and morning. We're now done with day 3. And God said, let there be lights in the heaven. By the way, sometimes we young earthers are criticized here when it comes to where did the light come from? Back in day 1, there's no sun. And well, where's the light in Genesis 22, 21 and 22? Is it not God? God is the source of light in the New Jerusalem. I would submit that the light back in day 1 is God. Okay, it's emanating from him. And that the light now he is going to create, it includes the sun that is our star in our solar system, as well as the other stars that hang in the expanse. So let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. And let them be, so the stars are out there in the expanse. Remember back in verse 6, God separated the waters. Okay, he put space between the waters. That was called the expanse, that space. What is hung in that expanse? You've got stars and you've got, you know, planets and the sun and all that. So some, including, for example, from Answers in Genesis, Terry Mortensen, who I've got some of his videos, they argue that the waters, and I am intrigued by this and I kind of lean this way, that the waters that were above were not the atmospheric waters. But those were the waters that separate way out there the second heaven from the third heaven. Second heaven, third heaven. You know, the Apostle Paul talks about three heavens. This is common in the, you know, in early literature. We're talking like, you know, way back literature in early human history. You know, the first heaven is Earth's atmosphere. Second heaven is what we would call outer space. And if Terry Mortensen and some of the others are right, then there is a water barrier way out there. They have some evidence. They've got a video that explains this and so forth, that there is water out there. And there were, you know, about a dozen verses in the Old Testament that talk about God encamping on that water and building on that water and the water even being ice today and so forth. Yeah, maybe. But it might be that the third heaven is beyond that ice barrier. Not to say that if you could penetrate the ice barrier and get on the other side, that you'd find God. That's not what that's saying. God's in a different dimension altogether. But that is a theory, and it's held by some. All right. I should also say that some down at AIG are debating right now that third option that I was talking about. In fact, they are, you can even see that third option that I'm talking about in the Creation Magazine, not Creation Magazine, in the, what is it? Yeah, in the Answers Magazine, in some of the footnotes, Andrew Snelling is talking about that third option. Okay, so that's a burgeoning belief, and there are more and more scientists and Christian theologians that are getting on that bandwagon. So I wouldn't be surprised if in 10 or 20 years we'll actually see a large portion of the conservative Christians in America and around the world that actually hold not to the 4004 BC, but something about 900 years earlier. Anyway, that's just a sidelight. I thought I would add that since I was talking about AIG. All right, now back to verse 14. Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and to let them be for signs and seasons, for days and years. Folks, people have been watching the heavens since Adam and Eve. I mean, they've been, you know, I mean, as soon as the fall and then the, you know, the flood and the Tower of Babel, archaeoastronomy, that's common. I mean, the pyramids, we're talking about temples and, you know, the summer and the winter solstices and, you know, the, you know, Stonehenge and so forth. Human beings have been watching the stars and doing exactly what verse 14 says for a very long time. Thousands of years. Verse 15, let them be lights in the expanse. If the expanse is as big as at least some believe, then that's the second heaven there that they're hung in. Either way, it's the second heaven, but they're hung there to give light on the earth, and it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. Again, everything is good. No sin, no death, nothing. Nothing that's bad. And there was evening and morning, the fourth day. And then we come to the fifth day, verse 20. God said, let the waters swarm. So he's already created things on the earth, the territory, terrestrial earth. He's also enhanced and beautified the heavens above. What has he not yet done? The waters. So now he, on the fifth day, creates in the world seas and oceans. Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So now we're clearly talking about the first heaven, that expanse. Because they're not flying in outer space. Okay, so fly above the earth, across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was, there it is again, good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. So water creatures and creatures of the air. And now we come to verse 24. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures. So he's put plants on the earth a couple days ago. Now he's going to put animals, creeping things and so forth on the earth. Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds. What? Livestock, creeping things, beasts. So livestock, domestic animals, beasts would be the wild ones. They're not wild yet in the same sense that we would consider them today. But that's the division here that Moses is using. So, beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, slightly different formula here. Look at what he says. Let us make man. Where did we come from? That's the question that worldviews and philosophy, that's what we want to know. Where did we know as Christians where we came from. It says it right here. Not from a chimpanzee great-grandparent. No. We came from the hand of God. Let us, I think an indication of the Trinity, make man in our image after our likeness. Another time we'll have to talk about image and likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. We are to have dominion. We still do. Man still, by God's allowance, is overseeing creation. Obviously, he is ultimately overseeing it, but he delegates authority to us. So God created in his own image, in the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. That's where we come from. Not from amoebas and not over millions or billions of years. Not from apes. We come from the creative hand of God. And God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth and every tree with its seed in it. One time I was witnessing to a guy and he was a pothead and he went to this verse, believe it or not, and said, see, this is why I can smoke pot because God gave us every, I'm like, oh my word. All right. I'm not even going to try to debate that one. Okay. You shall have, all right. So God gave plants for food and to every beast of the earth and every bird of the heavens and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made. And behold, there was just a little bit of sin in it. No. There was just a little bit of second law term problems. No. It wasn't just good this time, because this is kind of a cumulative statement. God says, or really the angel, according to the book of Acts, angels revealed this to Moses. It's very good. It was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. And then we come to the last three verses. I would like to have verses 1 through 3 of chapter 2 back up with chapter 1. But anyway, we can't stop at verse 31. We have to read the last three verses, or really the first three verses of chapter 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done. That's why we have a 7-day work week, folks. That's why the whole world does. Whether they like it or not, evolutionists ought to recognize this is where it comes from. We have a 7-day work week because that's the way God set it up.
On the seventh day, God finished his work, and he rested on that seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. Of course, we rest on the first day of the week, right? Because when Jesus raised from the dead in Christianity, we changed from the Sabbath, the seventh day, Saturday, to Sunday, the first day. Well, what we'll do, the Lord willing, next Sunday night, is look at the three intermediate views: deistic evolution, theistic evolution, and progressive creationism. And I think it's in those views that hopefully by covering them, it'll inoculate us against error. You know, you go for a shot and you get a little prick in the arm up here, and what does that, if you get in a flu shot, what does that flu shot do for you? Well, hopefully, if it's the right strain, it will protect you from getting the flu in that season. Well, if we look at error and study it in a controlled context, hopefully it will inoculate us against that error in the future. So, the Lord willing, we'll look at these three views next Sunday. Let's pray. Our Father, we've covered a lot of material tonight. Lord, we believe by faith that you are real, that you are there, and that you are the creator. You not only created, but you are the sustainer. You are also the one who provided, after the fall, the one that could remedy humanity's biggest problem, sin. You have created, you sustain, you have provided salvation through Christ. Lord, we owe everything to you. Our allegiance, our whole lives, we are your servants. Would you help us to recognize our position before you because of looking at this long text tonight, and as we can have considered these thought-provoking ideas. Protect us from those intellectual strongholds, those philosophies of the world that attack us and attack our foundations. Help us instead to fight back, and may the pulpits of America proclaim a literal Genesis 1. Would you give us a revival of that in our country? And would you protect the minds of the Christians in our church from the erosion that can be created by evolutionistic ideas? We pray in Jesus' name.